responsibility and accessibility. I mean, I think the Selma Gundy Club is something that needs to be mentioned here as always having had an accessibility among the common person, among people who don't feel, in some cases, feel disenfranchised because they feel kind of shut out of the Chelsea art world. In other cases, for just proximity to New York. And so having the Selma Gundy and having this atmosphere of open dialogue, I think, is really important. So, yeah, sure. Hey, how about you? I wanted to insert a joke, but maybe it's not a good time. All right, so I'm getting ready for my Selma Gundy speech, and I'm envisioning lofty goals of citadels of wisdom and pearls of knowledge, and I'm getting ready to leave today, and my 7-year-old says, "Hey, Daddy, did you know that a cockroach can survive weeks with no head?" It just puts it all into perspective, doesn't it? It's like, because, and by the way, no, there's nothing more horrific than a headless cockroach in my mind. So I'm not sure where my brain is after my 7-year-old torpedoed all my dreams for tonight. But I would say the thing that's foremost as a responsible action is to preach the fundamentals to my students, because I exist in a world of education, and education is paramount. And the thing that I see that is lacking is the connection to the profundity of the fundamentals. So I used to think that, you know, I could recognize that being a teacher made me a better artist, but there were things about that that sounded cliche. And it just was one of those things you talk to somebody about, it's like, yeah, you go back and you teach at a certain point. Once you've read Harold Speed for the 13th time, once you've memorized half the Vanderpool book, what do? You go back and you start teaching. But it wasn't teaching. It was constantly preaching this thing which is underestimated, and that is the fundamental practice and the fundamental aptitude, because I feel like staying connected to that has given me an appreciation and has given me a responsibility to future generations. So. Oh, thank you.
Say, Milan, that when I got this topic, I was one of those who probably wouldn't have raised their hand about responsibility and artists going together. And I did have to ponder it quite a bit, to think about those two. And actually, Dan helped with his comment about responsibility to students, and I have taught for a while now, and that's easy for me to see because I care deeply about my students. They're a special class of people, and they're fragile, and any teacher who's slightly responsible has to always be conscious that artists, like it or not, are exquisitely sensitive to their environment. That's why they're artists, and teachers of artists have to always have that in mind. So, yes, absolutely responsible there. But then I was thinking about individually as artists and what we paint and why we paint and what we choose to do. And I came up with Carol Fabricius. Most of us probably know his work. I brought visuals. All of us know the Goldfinch. Apparently, he's now extremely famous. An art dealer in New York said it's worth $200 million. It's 9 by 13 inches. Okay, so this is music to all of our ears, right? Because this is a wonderful painting. He was 30 years old, something like that, when he painted this. He died at 32 in a tragic explosion in The Hague. His other paintings aren't that remarkable, even though he was a student of Rembrandt. You can see the influence. But none of them, I mean, this is not Rembrandt, okay. He didn't know, I'm sure when he painted this, no one knows why he painted this, but this was probably some little painting to him. He didn't know this was going to be a great masterpiece. He never knew that. And that brings me to what is the responsibility that all of us are sculpting and painting. We're doing the best we can. And to me, that's our responsibility, period. Do the best work always that you can. And I came up with, here's what I would actually say very succinctly. Be humble and arrogant enough to do what you are called to do. Do it with all the skill, integrity, and insight you can muster, and then let it go. Because you will never know. Just do the best you can. And that means, the other thing about this Fabricius painting, and there's others like this that I could talk about, this is a great painting, not just because it's done skillfully and beautifully. This moves people deeply. And no one can really say why. If all of us were asked to say, we'd say something different. But that's what I think we have to do. We have to move people in ways that we don't even know we're doing when we do it. And that means we have to be moved. And that means we have to get out of our way, all those things that get in the way of being trained with our mind and paint with our heart. And that's the only thing that matters. Then you're being responsible. Good answer.
But I went through 25 years of hustling every month to sell sculpture in a market that is, I don't need to say the derogatory words, rubbish, but you get it. And then I got this project and everything changed because now there's a voice and then there's power and there's money behind it. So my responsibility to everyone in multiple sectors of society changes dramatically because I was a teacher and I was responsible to students. But now I'm responsible to humanity, I'm responsible to history, and I am also responsible to the people that come see this sculpture. And I learned a lot in this process about holding on to your heart and your values and your truth. And it is incredibly painful when you have many rat bastards coming at you and telling you to do something else. So the thing that artists are responsible for doing, and this is a difficult thing because of the connection with money, is they are responsible first and foremost for their family, and they have to also be first and foremost responsible for their art. This is a very tricky situation for everybody in the room. Especially when art is not valued in our society the way that it should be. And so I had a moment this summer in Florence in the Medici tomb when I was looking at Michelangelo's sculpture. He's my all-time favorite. And it's still the art that when I look at it, it's like I got sparks coming out all parts of my body. And my responsibility is to move forward and play forward art that is about humanity, it's about what we're worth as human beings. It's not ironic, it's about us and how valuable we are, each and every one of us. And so I belong to something that is larger than myself, and I serve. I serve through my art. And so when I sculpt every day, it's like every moment is really, really hard because I'm always on point. I have much perseverance. I don't feel I'm very talented, but I do feel I have tremendous drive. And I just push and push and push because every moment is my last. And so the art that is made has to be done in a way that is paid attention to by others. And so that is how I'm responsible in many ways in what I'm making right now. It's a very loaded question for me because I went through stuff that nobody would want to go through to get to this place. And so I just wish that things were different, and so in the art world, and I just have a very bad feeling about the gallery scene, and I wish it was a different way to change things. I do not feel the gallery scene is the way to change things, and that's why I entered this project, because I wanted to change things on a larger level than in my studio and in my home. So I think every artist's responsibility lies within what they see as potential. That's my answer. So I don't really have much else to say.
Do you each of you want to respond to what the other said, or on that question, or do you want to share further on some of the challenge that you faced?
Yeah, I think that also the school system is collapsing in many ways because it's a business, and I know that Dan and Judy have tremendous problems with dealing with administration and being able to do what they truly believe in. It's a very rough business.
Do you want to share some of those challenges? What has been the biggest challenge you've had to deal with, Dan, in as dean of Studio Incominati?
Oh man, where do I start? Maybe the 18-second attention span that people are hardwired to have now?
Yeah.
How about that? Getting somebody to concentrate on what they're doing because it's going to be helpful for them to transcend the ordinary through an exercise which will lead to more of an ability to aspire to heights that they had envisioned when they started dreaming of becoming an artist. I think in some ways, you know, the system is kind of engineered against that, because we're supposed to graduate people after a certain period of time, which was not the case in the master apprentice system, right? We're supposed to give them, you know, figure drawing one, they go through figure drawing one, okay, I know how to draw the figure now, so let's go do something else. And that's what I mean by the lack of adherence to fundamental thinking, because there's something that people are just sort of losing by not being compelled to dig more deeply into what it is they're supposed to study and what their forebears always studied, that I think is a kind of a crisis. I don't think it's getting better. I think it's kind of getting worse because of this notion of becoming popular, maybe. But I can say that the school that I run down in Philly has a modest admission charge. It's probably a quarter of what we would see in an MFA art school, maybe even a fifth. And so we don't want to bankrupt our students to get an education. So.
Well, I don't work well in the framework of institutions, so my teaching has always been in my own school, under my rules. Some of my students are here. They can attest to sort of that beginning speech about, come here, do what I say, don't argue with me, and you will be an artist. And so far, that's kind of worked. And because I don't want to argue, I think I know, because I learned it myself, I think I know what it takes to become an artist. And there's just no point in arguing about that. And if they want to argue, then they go someplace else. So I have control where it's quite different from what you're doing. But there's still the struggle of, you know, keeping track of students and, the business of having a school.
Yeah.
There's always all of that, trying to find a place to have a school. And, yes, and my husband became what I would call an accidental art patron, because he probably bankrolled a lot of it, because you don't make money with an art school. You just don't. That doesn't happen. So you always have to be helped by someone. So
can I just add to what they said?
Yeah.
There are no shortcuts to this point. of mastery and excellence, and to do something that sparks that same feeling in others that you have when you make your art. And that is my concern, that there are many newfangled approaches that are enhanced due to computers. And so what has happened is, in the school system, for what that I am seeing externally, is that the students don't have the same framework of that time changes when you make art of great excellence, and that it takes tremendous perseverance, time, energy on a daily level that's almost monastic. And you need to have so much internal drive and fortitude to hold that path and vision, especially in a city like New York City, where, you know, to make rent you need X amount of dollars, even as a young kid. So that's the issue. You need massive talent to proceed, and you need to do a lot of work to get there. And I don't see that so much in schools, and it's very sad to me. And all the art that I see coming out of sculpture, with all this stuff about digital and photogrammetry, is all bullshit, because you can't skip the steps. You have to do the actual looking at the model and then sculpting in a way that is what was going on 500 years ago. And sure, that stuff helps you speed it along, but at the end of the day, it's the aesthetics of looking and translating that into the proportions of, you know, spinning and answer and returning curves, and the anatomy and the structure and the geometry and all the good stuff that's actually valuable. And so there's these aesthetics that are being replaced that are frankly crap, because they're like from photographs. And that's not what, to me, art is. That's digital and mechanical, and it's not what is human. And what Dan and Judy do and teach from a prior way of being is they have a way of seeing that is not artificially enhanced, but it's from their brain and their heart. And that is our responsibility as artists, to continue that legacy. And frankly, it sucks, because it's dark. But that's our deal.
I mean, and if I can add to that, that one of the things that does worry me a little bit is the extension of what Sabin just talked about, which is all these enhanced ways of making art is bad enough for the people making art, but for the people viewing art, I honestly would love to see someone do a study of what digitalization and photography has done to the human ability to actually see.
Yep.
And I'm so surprised to see even sophisticated consumers of art not be able to make distinctions between something that's mediocre and something that's great. They do not see it. And I don't know what we do about that. I don't know if there's anything artists can do about that. And it troubles me, because I just don't see an answer to it.
I think partly it comes to education and exposure. I can speak for myself. I'll never forget when I first entered the Grand Central Atelier, and I was seeing all the student work around. And to me, I thought, this is fantastic. It's amazing. But it all looks the same to me, right? A year later, I could tell each artist who drew each one of those figures of the same model. I could distinguish. And a year later, I could tell which one was better than the other. And then I would ghost judge the competitions here. I would be a ghost judge to see. And we would all match the first cut. We all agreed on the first cut. It was like maybe the top 10 that were hard to decide on, but there was that hierarchy of quality that we all agreed on, which brings me to actually, it was my last question, but while I'm on it. Yes?
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So are you saying there are objective, measurable standards for deciding what is great art?
It seems to be, yes. I wonder, is there a hierarchy?
Because we live in a time when there are no, everything is relative. There are no standards.
Well, that's the belief, but is that true?
Well, I think the time believes that. designers know who's good and who's not.
Right.
So, but the belief culturally, generally, is that there are no objective measurable standards, and there's no difference between self-expression and art.
Well, we don't have to agree with that, right? If that's the status quo, does it mean we don't have to agree with it? But it seems to be the status quo. Like somebody, when I talk about aesthetic principles of truth and beauty, and somebody, and I get the answer, well, what is truth? How can you say what is? Well, we're all here in this room, right? That's true. And then you can take that further down at different levels, down to the aesthetic way of looking at aesthetic principles. So let's touch on that a bit further. How do you describe that hierarchy of quality in art? Is that something? How do you describe that in a way that makes sense?
Quality in art?
Is there a hierarchy?
Is there a hierarchy?
Is everything relative, or is there actually a hierarchy when you can discern quality?
I think there are two elements to the... I mean, this is my take. Okay. There are two elements here. There's a universal standard of excellence, and then there is an individual way of achieving that universal excellence of art. So everybody who paints, sculpture, draws, perceives things differently, and has had a different experience in their life, and it's like some people like French art more, they like German art more, they like Italian art more, or they like Jackson Pollock more. That's driven by their genetic DNA and their history and where they grew up and what experiences they've had, so environmental and also genetic. And that's the unique ability to see the world and translate the world into art. So here's where I think things fall short. There's plenty of self-expression out there. But what is lacking is education and a way to translate that reality of the world into artistic terms and form. That's what's missing. That's what's gone really down the... I was going to say shitter, but we will. The education system has really failed in a big way because of phones, digitalization, and just the lack of that old-fashioned looking at the model and translating it through an education system. So when I was 19, I couldn't draw at all. And I was very lucky that I got an education with Walter Erlbacher and Martha Erlbacher and Tony Visco and Harvey Citron. As a really young kid, and then I went to Italy, and I had Paolo Carassoni in Rome, and so I got a really good education from the beginning, so that was my way of translating reality and the model. And then the other part was the expression, that everybody has that, but then the last part that I haven't talked about up to now is the vision, the artistic vision, and there are better artistic visions than others, we all know that. What I object to also, and this is tricky, I think GCA in some ways has done a disservice to the figure of art world because it relies too much on the technical aspect and not enough on the how do you say something with your technique. And so then how do you go to the next level artistically and make something that is universal and everybody's like sees it and is blown out of the water. That's the actual, to me, it's the narration or the storytelling, and I'm lucky that I have a wife who's a novelist, so I learned a lot about storytelling. But storytelling and what you speak about is also critical. So that's, yes?
I have a question. If the collectors and sophisticated collectors cannot differentiate between working from life and working from photographs,
yes.
How are you as artists going to change the way the viewing collectors accept your work? In other words, how do you change this culture working from life? So.
Well, one thing I'd like to say just quickly is if we ever solve this, It will be because people like Milen and Peter Trippi are on the scene trying to translate this for the public, trying to educate, trying to find obscure painters doing great things and bringing it to people's attention. That is so needed because, you know, I don't see any good art criticism these days. It's lacking. And I think that needs to be fixed. We are very grateful to have Milen and Peter, and probably others that I'm failing to mention. But
the second part of that question is it the goal of artists...
You only get one question.
Well,
just kidding.
I'm so sorry. Is it the goal of artists really to create a masterpiece? I mean, is that your goal when you work? Do you have a goal when you sit down to create a work? You have your model in front of you, you start your drawing or your painting. Are you thinking, oh, I'm going to create a masterpiece? Or is that a false premise that has been put onto artists today that everything has to be, quote unquote, a masterpiece? You know, has to be a major work by this artist.
So is that something artists should be responsible for? I would rephrase it and go back to one of my questions, which is, do you think artists are responsible for helping to uplift the moral fabric of society?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And if so, then how? What part of that takes on the form or of your piece or the content? So maybe Dan, maybe you just speak.
There's so many things I want to answer. I think if I can go back several paragraphs ago, there is an objective, quantifiable measure of a great education and a lousy education. And we're after a great education because we want people to be able to transform themselves through being thrust into a situation which doesn't feel like it's a 15-weeker, it's a lifetime of setting up a love of learning. And once they do that, if they do that, if anybody is going to do that, if anybody's left in the world that is willing to put in the 10 years to learn how to be an artist, then they can go, you know, do whatever they want. And I think it will be affected by that training. In fact, I know it will. I don't know that they have to paint like anybody that I've ever heard of or seen or ever will know. But I know that will affect them. And I know it will affect them in a positive way. And regarding your question, I think that if you meet your collectors now, as opposed to the old days when we used to sell a painting and you'd say, well, oh, you sold a painting today. And I said, oh, who bought it? A collector of ours, a long-time collector of ours bought it. And you just never knew who bought your painting. But now you've got this sense of enthusiasm and exuberance, and this is why they bought it. And we just have this heart-to-heart, you know, this conversation about what was meaningful, about what we created. And there's much more of that now than there used to be. So I'm encouraged by that.
And that's because of the demise of the galleries. The galleries are losing the whole.
And I think it's also, it's the rise of a confidence in the collector class that what they love, they have a right to love. You know?
Seems to come back down to education.
Thank you for your comments. If for you, Judith, there's no great art criticism now, would you be able to provide an example of two or two of art critics you respect or great art understand?
Well, anything Milen has written and anything Peter has written. So that's a start. Yeah.
I wish there were 100 more of people.
Yeah. And I'd like to just add something about this, the masterpiece question. And none of us will ever know what painting will be the masterpiece, but we always go in there thinking, this will be the best. It has to be the best. And I'm reminded of something I heard Patty Watwood, a great artist who's here tonight, said at one of these panel discussions. And it stuck with me because she said, you know that you're looking at really fine representational art because it's not ironic. And it's not cynical. And so the word sincerity, it comes to mind that You know, there's always a cheap thing you can do. We all know what they are. There'll be a crowd pleaser, and we'll probably sell it, and now we can pay the rent. We're all caught in that. And we all try to do the best we can to avoid it. Because we're always, I believe this about, certainly about my fellow panelists and about all the artists that I know, always it has to be the best. It just, that's what you're striving for, always, I think.
Mm-hmm. So the crowd pleaser also like forces of the market. How do you, Sabin, I mean, you've been doing this World War I memorial several years now, and it's already in life's, I mean, the size it's supposed to be, and it's just starting in that mode. And you've dealt with many regulatory committees going back and forth with them, and you've had to, throughout this whole process, like stick to your vision as an artist and also speed up the process, you know, by using some technology. So how have you felt through that whole process of staying true to your vision as an artist? And
I think if I tell a story, it will have the greatest impact for you guys. In the beginning, when I got the project, I was very excited, and then I went to Washington, and I was like, okay, so you guys, we need to sit down to discuss money, and we're at the table, and they go, oh, we have no money.
Can you speak into the microphone?
Yeah.
I went to Washington in the beginning, and I asked my client, we need to discuss the terms of the project, and the client said, we have no money. So this is a national project, and so that was the beginning, where you win a global competition with 360 global teams, and I wanted because I wasn't digital, and the client wanted something that looked like what is in front of the Capitol building. Okay, so then Milan is correct, I had to go through many regulatory commissions of people that know nothing about art, and that gets very, very dangerous, because then they're all telling you what to do. And their background in terms of art is nil. Half of them have never been to the museum, and most of them are into trees and benches and parks, because they're landscape architects that have been appointed by government officials. So this is who holds the gate, yay or nay, for projects, and so the Eisenhower Memorial took 15 years to get through that gate, and it should take another 15 years, but it got through anyway. I was told then by all these people, okay, you gotta do this and this and this and this. And here I get a project that I know nothing about, because I don't know how to do figure compositions, never did it before, but I had an idea how to put a figure together because of the anatomy and the structural aspect. So I was very confused 3 months in, because I was being told to put airplanes, tanks, horses, all these things in. And just throw it all on in there and you're good to go. Because everybody's, you know, Navy, Army, or what? It's like, don't leave out anything. So then I go into my bathroom, not to puke, but to look. And I see this poster on the wall, and it was the Last Judgment, Michelangelo's Last Judgment. And it was a moment of, like, I heard in my ear, do what you know. Mm-hmm. And so I saw all these figures that were intertwined together like pretzels, and it was Michelangelo, and I was like, he did it. That's what I do. So you can make, I don't know if you can make the correlation, but Last Judgment is everybody meeting their maker, so you're dealing with everybody here. How, that's what I did. I took that and I started composing models with my cell phone, doing bursts in my studio, and it was a moment of like, okay, you know what you're doing now. Do this, and then I started doing these iterations, and the more you do it, the better you get. I held on to my vision through a production process in New Zealand, through my design team telling me to change things, through the commission that hired me, through the Commission of Fine Arts in Washington, and I lost a lot of joy in art, And I became very cynical in art, but I also realized how valuable it is. And so it kind of made me grow up in a way that I wouldn't want to have anybody else go through that. With that growing up, I realized that I don't mean to sound arrogant. I know what I'm doing, and I need to keep going because I need to make something that is responsible to that guy who lost his legs or the guy who lost his best friend in combat. And I started to have veterans come up to me after a talk, and they were crying. And so my art, all of a sudden, was, that's what I said, it was about serving others, and then I realized you were also not only serving that person, you were also serving tradition, and the tradition that you need to play forward. And then we started a new business model, and I started, how do I put this together in 4 years? How do you put a 38-figure composition together in 4 years with holding on to your principles and values? And so then every step of the way for me is a learning experience because I've never been here before. And I think that's the responsibility of the artist to always grow and not become formulaic. And that, I think, is a very dangerous thing when artists continue to paint the same still life work. And I'm not being critical of anybody, but I think it's dangerous that if you don't put yourself in harm's way and try stuff that you can actually fail at, you're not going to grow as an artist. And I think schools are very dangerous when they teach art, but they don't teach you to go to the next level and then do something with the art. And that's why I'm really scared about the figurative art tradition, because it's not moving into a business system where there's a patron and then there's an exchange. So I feel that when you move into a system where the patron challenges you to do things that you would not normally do, your art expands. And so I think that that's a very important thing for figurative artists today. And I wish the school system had a better system to engage students in how to then engage with the patrons and make something that is a transaction with someone else rather than doing it just alone in their studio. So it becomes more contained within a society rather than an isolated incident in a studio. I finished a sculpture that I spent 3,500 hours with prior to this project, and I thought, oh, now I'm going to go someplace. This is my masterpiece. And it didn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it was a very big wake-up call for me because I realized that it was too esoteric and did not carry enough of these other values that society needs to see within our art. And so I hope that answers it, not too rambling.
Okay, thank you for sharing.
Yes, I have a question.
Yeah.
You first mentioned your responsibility to your family.
Yeah.
And now you're talking about the question of integrity in your work.
Yeah.
Do you compromise at any point, or do you follow your integrity and lose the money that you might get for the job?
Tracy's going to answer that.
I refer this to Peter Trippi, who wrote a wonderful article about the bad boundaries between the museum and the marketplace. This comes back to corporate greed. People want to buy paintings that hang on the wall and get more valuable, or match their drapery, hang on the wall, and get more valuable. They're not looking for art in a very general way, and this doesn't apply to everyone. But what that means is that a museum wants to put on a show for an artist who paints a lot of paintings that can hang on the wall, get more valuable, and match people's furniture. And because museums want to do that, the galleries want to represent that artist because, man, that artist can make them some money, right? So you've got the museums and the galleries in cahoots. And it's a problem for real art where people are experimenting and getting some things wrong and failing and then getting something right that no one ever thought of. End of rant. And Peter Kirby has a wonderful article about this.
What's the title of the article?
You should read Peter's article about it. The museum and the gallery need better boundaries. And in any other field of enterprise in our world, it's like corruption. The way the museum and the gallery come together, it's like they're breaking all kinds of like monopoly laws and non-compete laws and all this. But in art, they can do it. And it's not good for artists who are trying to like create, express, invent, move forward.
So. I thought that was true.
I'm not talking about something a little different.
Yeah.
You were hedging on the idea of doing things with integrity, I guess artistically, as well as probably history and fame.
Yeah.
Or humanity.
Yeah.
Yet the people who employed you may have other ideas about how to show that World War I experience. And that's what I'm thinking.
I
think you understand.
Yeah, totally I do. I was very, very stubborn, so much so that I would go to a meeting with all three clients, maybe 10 or 8 people at the table, and I would use the F word, and they would say, well, this is a national memorial, you need to change it. And I said, I don't care if this is an effing memorial, I'm more interested in making a great piece of art, and that's what the road that I'm going to follow. And I refused to change the composition at a certain point because I wasn't going to let it be just torn apart by people that didn't know how to make art. And I knew that I had the power to do that because they couldn't kick me out because they'd run a global competition. And for them to start over again, they were screwed. So it's always a matter of playing these kind of very lawyerly games with your client. And it's a whole other discussion about responsibility that comes up here because you are really, okay, how much can I push to maintain what I need to do and still, you know, pitch this client so he'll get on my bus and we can proceed forward.
Well, maybe he never will.
But I think each situation is unique, right? And then how much money is involved? And I keep saying the word money. I hate it.
Yeah.
It's a terrible thing, and it's also a wonderful thing.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
I just got to know. I'm sorry. I'm dying to know this. Was your integrity forged out of your devotion to fine figurative work and a fascination with that unbelievably epic period in human history, or what?
No, I don't know anything about World War I to a certain point.
Really?
I never read a single book about World War I. I'm being very honest with you all. Mm. My experience of World War I came from two things. Looking at actors from Brooklyn posing in my studio in real uniforms under lights, and then realizing the horrors of war when I heard several stories. One actor who worked for me and his great uncle had served, and his great grandfather had served, and his great grandfather died. His great uncle came home and shot his wife, and then shot his daughter, and then shot himself. Mm-hmm. And so then you hear these stories, and then I can talk about it now, but I could not talk about it before. I don't know how to explain it. I never read anything about World War I. I thought about how do you tell a story that is going to be impactful to everyone who comes to see. And then I used the visual abilities to set up models and the expression of humanity. And then I thought about what is World War I, and then how is that different than any other war? Because all wars in some ways are the same, in which, you know, men and women, then just men, leave home, they go to a different land and experience a traumatic experience, and that transforms them, and then they come home different. And then they have that choice to bring that back to society, and that wisdom can change society for the better. And that was the positive thing I wanted to bring to war about. I hate war. I grew up in Vietnam, era, and my parents were big anti-Vietnam people, and I was at all the war marches. I heard Martin Luther King talk in Washington. So I was very much exposed to the horrors of the 60s and 70s. And so my experience of war was the woman, the little girl who was 14 years old running directly at you, completely naked, from a napalm. And that's what I remembered when I was doing the project. I didn't read all these history books because I felt that was all here, and this is what I wanted. I wanted my heart to lead me visually.
Interesting, yeah.
I hope that...
Yeah.
Thank you. Here we're done.
I have a question.
Go ahead, in the back.
Statement and question I'd like to ask. When I was growing up on Long Island, and we didn't know about life. It was a matter of survival, because I'm a few years older than that. Our potato farms out there, but no family was going by more or taking their kids to the museum. When I got to college at Hofstra, we had to take like an art class. So I took art appreciation. And this was got my interest in art. We never met in class. Every week, we'd have to meet in a museum. And she would take us, her name was Amy, and she would take us from one museum to the other. And we'd have to stand, and she would explain art to us. I'm a collector, not an artist. And she would explain art. What are we looking at? What is that? What do you think it is? And it made us start looking at art. And that was my first time that I started actually understanding art and looking at it. And then I started going to lectures, finding out what art is, what is this, what is that. It was really an education. But as far as the artists go, and I've heard Sabin talk several times, and I think it's important, why do collectors collect? Why do they buy? What do they see? What's digital art? What is a print? And I think it's an important part, the responsibility of the artist too, because even if they have a gallery, if they have an opening, or if they have a talk, it's that they talk about it. They bring us into it and make us want to be part of it, make us want to take a second look and say, oh, look at that. That's interesting, where he was when he did it or when she did it. And I think it's their responsibility to bring people in, to be part of this, and not just hang it and walk away or leave it up to the gallery, but I think that you have to be part of the process of educating all of us on what the art is or what you went through to actually even bring it to fruition and we're actually looking at it. So now when we look at your memorial, we'll look at it and say, God, look what I went through. Oh, my God. You know, and then you kind of start appreciating it.
Yep.
Or how many years it took you to get where you go and whatever you're doing. Or education. I'm a true believer, not only for the children, for the high school, but even in college, to bring back art appreciation. So people know what they're looking about, so they don't put a poster on the wall and think it's, you know, the greatest thing they've ever seen.
Okay.
So I think you have a responsibility, too, to bring us along with your art.
But you can go to the museum. And you're like an old man who remembers. He is not physically there. And he cannot speak.
But
so
you know what?
You spend enough time over there.
I find it more
the
exciting.
Speaking to you.
But you know what?
And
if I don't know and I'm just looking at it, but if I have somebody, sometimes I go on tours,
I think we can all agree that all of us have different tastes in art, right? But I think also there is an understanding of what is high quality, like what we spoke of before. And I think we are, in a sense, living in a dark ages right now in terms of visual art, because art education right now is terrible, absolutely terrible. You know, students don't know even what perspective is. So I think this is a crucial issue that the panelists brought up, especially Dan, initially.
I'd like you to address the question of art schools, colleges, universities. They teach art, but the majority of it is abstract art, and people think that is the contemporary art of the day. I think most of us, people up here, are more realist of one sort or another. Now the question is, when you talk about appreciation, if people only get that kind of input or education or brainwashing about art, they don't know how to judge the realism that you're talking about. But so the question really is, how do we change the education system so that it really is a democratic freedom of expression? Because if people want to learn any kind of realistic art in the colleges, they don't have the opportunity. They got rid of the people who can teach the skills, and they're not interested in it. That's been my experience. I'm old.
It's not just the freedom of expression, but it's the learning of the tradition that it has taken centuries and centuries, and there's value in that. Extreme value. And which brings me to one of my questions, which is, is high culture necessary for feeling higher, more refined emotions?
Yes.
You want to elaborate on that?
No.
Judy?
No, it just is.
Or explain maybe some of your experiences with that.
I have to think about it a minute.
I can answer that.
Okay.
Dan, do you want to say something?
I want to jump on that if I can.
Yeah,
I'm loving me some Max Ginsburg questions here. I mean, back to what Bonnie said, drawing is art appreciation now, because drawing is teaching close observation. We're doing an interdisciplinary course now in one of the schools with medical students, because they are not looking at people. They've got their heads buried in computers as they look at programming, and this is, okay, the patient has this symptom, that symptom. They must have this. It must be that. And by looking at somebody and by really observing and doing that, that was a great word, monastic, that you used. But it's a hermetic kind of thing, but it's transformative. It really is like a transition out of one state to another, where you start to appreciate what seeing is, not looking, but seeing. And I think that really should be taught to younger people in an observational drawing sense. I think more interdisciplinary things between subjects should be focused on as well. And I think it should be done earlier as a matter of acceptance that this is part of innate human existence, to appreciate what you are seeing. And it isn't right now. I mean, my kids are 7 and 10. They're in school right now. And they've got an art class, but it's like what you said. It's not really an art class. And we talk about it when they get home. And we talk about, you know, what did you see? And what did you learn? And how did you grow? How did you transform? Was there a metamorphosis? I don't think so. But it's just really important, I think, to maybe you separate out and say, look, you know, we're not teaching art, we're teaching drawing. We're not teaching art, we're teaching painting. But somehow the other side has to get it in their head that we're just advocating to know something. We're just advocating to know. And don't tell us not to know something. You know, don't tell us it's worth throwing out, you know, 30 generations of knowledge and wisdom for the sake of what's popular today.
We have 15 minutes left. Beauty. We haven't talked about beauty. Truth and beauty. What about the aesthetic principle of beauty? Is that still relevant today? How do we understand it today? Is there a timeless responsibility that artists have had over the centuries that continues on to today? Let's b- bundle all that together as we, you know, in these last 15 minutes. Judy?
Oh, tough. This is just very personal, my own feelings about things. That my view is that the world can be an ugly place. Ugly things happen, wars happen, terrible things happen. I don't think that the artist's job is to put that in our face. We already know it. We need to escape it. We're not saying it's not happening. We're not discouraged by it. I mean, we are discouraged about it. We want to make it better. But I don't think it's the job of the artist to expand it. I think it's our job to make us look at something else that we know is real. Even in the middle of something terrible, there is always, I mean, we learned this in 9/11 in New York, and we didn't learn anything else. In the middle of the worst evil that we saw, I'm sure all of us had this experience of seeing more love than we had ever seen in this city. And so to me, the uglier it gets, the more beauty we need to have. That's a responsibility to uplift, to not to make the ugly uglier. I just don't see the point in that.
Thank you. Dan, would you like to comment?
Beauty is cadence. Beauty is knowledge of your language to such a profound extent that you have found yourself, you're able to respond instinctively what you see, because you don't have to stumble over how to draw something or how to paint something or how to sculpt something. Beauty is in the voice of past artists like Gracely. I think beauty is in the enjoyment, learning about the stories. We just talked about St. Gaudens, who I'm sure you love too, and this model for the St. Gaudens monument that's in front of the Plaza Hotel of Sherman, General Sherman. And the model was Hetty Anderson, this African-American model from South Carolina. Of course, you know, Sherman would think of that. Of course he would think through all aspects of his commission and bring in things that we wouldn't even be thinking about for generations. So I think cadence is really where beauty is vision. You know, vision, somebody's vision that they carry with them because they have moved beyond the rudimentary things.
The thing that scares me is there are different types of beauty, and beauty can have multiple levels of depth. So you can have a beautiful commercial, like a Chanel commercial, but it has no depth. And so this is something that scares me a lot with ateliers, that they may teach a student to do something that's very beautiful, but then it doesn't have the depth that I would like to see. And I would like to see an art that has massive depth, but also has a personal vision through, driven by an education and an experience of a unique individual's life on the planet. And that's when you get something that will withstand the test of history and time, because it takes a unique individual's vision, the way that he sees the world, through, driven by his education. That's what's needed to say something more than just something that's harmonious. And that's dangerous. And what Judy said, it's not. I don't see art as an escape. I see it as a way that it is a representation of us culturally. So do we really want to be represented by a block of cinder blocks on the ground? No, we want to be represented by something that elevates our spirit and helps us go to that place.
Responsibility to artists to share your knowledge with those that
I have an answer. I just don't want to hog the mic, that's all. I mean, it's like, I do stuff in bronze, so it's going to be there before a long time after I'm dead. And so I was really frustrated as a teacher teaching for 20 years because I felt like Sisyphus pushing a boulder up a hill. So every semester I'd get, or every year I would get new students, and they had the same mistakes that the previous batch had. And it was like just grueling, the amount of energy I would give and give and give and give. And it felt like maybe one out of, I don't know, 500 would actually really hit a home run and come out. And so I felt like, okay, this is not working for me personally. So I got into the business of, like, I thought about it for a long time, and it didn't come to me right away, but I want to make a difference with my life. And I really believe that the art that has been held up historically needs to survive. And so I thought to myself, how can you do this? And you're not going to do it in the gallery system, and you're not going to do it in the educational academic system. So I went into this system, and that was my way to combat the world as it is today. And so I hope that this project is the first of many. And so I have engaged in creating a business where I have two other sculptors with me, and I'll bring in others. And it's a way to make something that is present to maybe 5,000 people a day, so then I can make a difference that way, and then I can have a platform, and I can talk about the bullshit that Jeff Koons and Damien Hirst create, and stand up to the crap that the academia has put in front of us. All the resistance and all the roadblocks and all the bullshit of modernism, and how that's my way of combating it, because now all of a sudden I have like some power behind me. So now all of a sudden I might be heard. And so I think it's very, very frustrating for a lot of artists that are amazing, that they need to break the cycle, and it's a really hard thing to do.
I have not nearly as global a thought, and deep a thought as that about responsibility in teaching. And this was something I came up when I started my atelier, that I had experienced, I think when I was in college, I was in the 60s trying to study art, and no one wanted to teach me what I wanted to learn. They couldn't or wouldn't. I failed every art course in college I taught, and that delayed my time of being a painter by about 20 years, because it was very painful to me. And I thought, anything that hurts that much, I better just stay away from. So that's number one responsibility to an art student. Don't make them suicidal about art, please. And then the next thing was, I talked to, about the time I was starting my atelier, I talked to the head of a very prestigious art school in New York that was trying to teach the right things. And he told me that the rate of fall off of a student graduating with an MFA from a pretty good art school in New York was an unbelievable 80%. 80. Now, if Harvard did that, they would have been out of business a long time ago. But people have such low expectations about anything involving art, they don't think that's a scandal that people are paying for an education that they leave by 80%. Okay. So I started examining why that's happening. And I don't know that I know, but one thing I do know from my own experience was that students go to art school, they get good training, they leave, they get a little studio, they have no money, nobody in their family thinks this is a good idea, they have no support, and they're in there and they're painting their painting, and it will happen to every artist. It happens to me now, it probably happens to everybody, no matter how experienced they get. You have a painting that all of a sudden falls apart and you can't fix it. and you are devastated. You want to kill yourself. This is, you're an artist. You're sensitive. And it shouldn't be that way, but it is. Okay. So here's this graduated student, alone, poor, unappreciated, and this happens. And there's no one there. So I said, that's not going to happen in my school. In my school, they're going to finish their 50 projects they have to do to graduate. And then if they want, they will be given a space where they start their own projects. And I'm there. And I got very good at sensing when this crisis was happening, because no one will admit it. But suddenly they're spending a lot of time in the lounge. And I would go in and haul them out of the lounge, take them back to their studio, and say, you know, just look at this and look at that, and we can save this. And I mean, we've all had this experience of the enormous relief of the student to know that it's their life isn't over. This can be fixed, and they are there for another day. And we do this day after day after day. And that was what I felt was my greatest responsibility, to never let any student be alone when they have that moment of crisis. Because it's not trivial. It's a serious, serious thing. And I just am afraid that too many art schools don't have the time. You know, it takes time to do that. And, you know, if you have your own school, you can afford to do that maybe. But if I had to say anything about art education, it would be to encourage that kind of thing, of being there. Be the safety net when it falls apart. Yeah.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. I think it's been
great. Thank you. Thank you.